of the big reasons why he located next to Mr. Sage was that in 1867 there was a railroad called the Jackson, Lansing, and Saginaw Railroad, which extended from Saginaw to Winona. And of course, Winona later on was called West Bay City. The reason probably Mr. Davidson came here also was that this railroad, which came alongside of these slips, would offer him a good form of transportation for his much needed materials, such as oak timber and his boilers and engines and whatnot that would have been used in making the ships. Another reason why he located in Bay City was because there was a large sandbar up near Carlton that stretched across the river, and yet today they have trouble at low times with this particular sandbar. And if a ship in those days, let's say in the 1870s and 80s, would draft over 7 or 8 feet, and sometimes with a heavy gale, no ship at all could get to Saginaw. Saginaw was a completely landlocked city. But Mr. Davidson must have knew Mr. Sage, and he probably did by at times when they got a little low on certain lumber. He probably did, but I have never come across any of my research work where he bought anything from Sage.
Well, then let me ask you this. Did Captain Davidson build ships for Sage? We know that lumber barges were used extensively in this area. Did Davidson make any ships of this type for?
No. I have never run across that either. One particular fact is probably that there is what they call a master ship's carpenter would build ships for different people. Now, I know for a fact that there was one lumber mill back in the late 1870s that the master carpenter went to this particular mill and during the winter proceeded to build a barge or a schooner, whatever the particular person wanted, right on his property. And this also would have been the case with Mr. Sage. If he would want a particular type barge, he would have employed a master carpenter to build it. For the simple reason, it would have been cheaper because he would have the lumber right there. His own mill would cut the lumber and his own planers would plane it and whatnot. So all it would have cost was just the labor of the master ship's carpenter.
Mm-hmm. Question number two then, how did the economic fluctuations of Bay City's economy affect the shipbuilding industry? Now I'm speaking here of number one, undoubtedly the most important economic boom was that of the lumber boom.
That's right.
As that ended, how did the people that were working in the lumber mills and the logging camps and things like that, how did they make a living? Did they go into shipbuilding?
Well, not particularly. Most of course, your lumbering period was really ending by the time of the 1880s rolled around. It was on its way out. Of course, there was a lot of other industries in here, small type industries that made barrels and whatnot. But your big shipbuilding, the big upswing in shipbuilding started in about 1887 to 1891. At this particular time, there was a great many vessels built. And then, of course, in that, with let's say 1890 particularly, Mr. Wheeler went into building the steel ships. In 1888, when he was contemplating this, he had said that he was going to build these steel ships and there was a bright future for it. So the Bay City Tribune reporter went and seen Mr. Davidson and asked him, was he going to do the same thing? And Davidson said, no, he says, the era of wooden shipbuilding is over. And he recognized this himself. And so he just gradually fell because the price of oak was... And there's one interesting thing, too, that it is said that to build one of these large vessels, let's say a 300-footer, would have taken over 50 acres of oak to build one vessel. Mm. Of course, not every oak was used out of an acre. I mean, oaks don't grow as tight as what pine did. But still, 50 acres for one vessel, and they would build as high as, I'd say, particularly some years, they'd have as high as 12 ships being launched in 1 year. So I really don't think the lumber industry had an important impact on shipbuilding, but not as much as what the iron ore trade did. Because in the 1880s, in the early 1890s, of course, the railroads were pushing west, everything was opening up, and there was a great demand for more steel. And they also built the sulaks were being built bigger, and of course this would allow a deeper draft ship and a larger ship to go through. So then they just needed more ships.
And we'll say then, talking about Bay City, we know that in the state of Michigan we had the two real big economic booms. That was the lumber boom and the mining boom. Mm-hmm. But talking about Bay City specifically, we could say then that we had another economic boom, which we could call a shipbuilding boom.
I would say yes.
And then from there we go in, as you mentioned, the mining era, which they're building an entirely different type of ship. Am I correct?
Yes, a much larger vessel. For example, in 1888, in April, Wheeler had 11 vessels in contract, and he employed 670 men, which paid out about $7,000 in wages a week. And these contracts ran well over $1 million. So you can see right there that. And then the shipbuilders also got a little bit more, I imagine, than what the lumbermen did working in the mills. As far as the lumbermen from the out in the fields or out in the woods, most of these were farmers and were seasonal work.
Mm-hmm.
They worked during the wintertime.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get a little more specific here now. I'll ask you this. How many workers did Davidson employ in the early days of his business? We'll say 1873 until the peak of the shipbuilding boom.
Well, when he started out, he had about 40 men working for him. And in 1886, it kind of went up to, I think it was something like 60 men. And then he kind of got, of course, a bigger scale. And he had about 200 to 300 men working for him at one particular time. Now, of course, he had a much smaller operation than what Mr. Wheeler did. We find that in 1887, that his men went on strike. They complained they weren't getting up and they wanted 12.5 cents more a day for wages. And of course, Mr. Davidson, being a businessman, said this was utterly ridiculous, so he just hired the men in the place of these strikers, and they were just plain out of luck. In those days, I imagine once you went on strike, I mean, being non-union in place, you couldn't get a job nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Mr. Davidson in 1888 had over $1 million worth of contracts. But one thing difference is that Mr. Davidson built most of these vessels for himself, where Mr. Wheeler built only on a contract basis. But he covered himself by making himself, we can say he had incorporated as a shipping company, but never really did. He never really ran these vessels. They're always sold on contract.
Well, let me interrupt you a second now. When you say that Mr. Davidson built his ships for himself, did he build them and then use them in his own?
Yes, he used.
Would he lease them out to these firms?
No, he never leased. There was a Davidson Steamship Company, and they, of course, were ore and grain trade. Not too many wooden vessels or lumber type vessels, because by the 1880s, these vessels were underway and was going by rail.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Davidson, of course, like I said, had his own shipping company, and this is where he made his money, because, of course, he built his own ships, and there was a saving right there. He built them at cost for himself, and then they made money for him, where Mr. Wheeler didn't. I really don't know what the wage scale is, because I've never found it. Even going through some of my reference books here, it never really stated. Although I know Mr. Wheeler, his men went on strike one time because they were getting a nickel less an hour than they were getting in Detroit for riveter. Now, a riveter was the highest paid man, from what I understand, in the shipyard. As far as a straight hourly wage, I've never ran across this as yet.
What class of workers would you, how would you break these men down into classes of workers, would you say? Skilled labor and unskilled, or
that's right.
And under those occupations, under those titles, would there be riveter and just laborer? There must have been more than that.
Well, there was. Let's take the year 1889. He started to build his steel ships. Well, of course, he kind of had to have special men, so he kind of went out and out east, and he got some of these men to come back and help. But then they also were building wooden ships at the same time. So you had, like you said, you had a skilled laborer and an unskilled laborer. Now, your skilled laborer would be your riveter, your master carpenter, which would, of course, been working on the wooden ships. Then you just have your common laborer, like the guy who caulked a ship. And, for example, they had an old guy that would go along and pick up rivets off the ground, because so this was all money saving. But there was this two classes, skilled and unskilled labor, like you have today. And so it had to be the same thing. It's also worth noting that in 1888, Mr. Wheeler was really getting serious about building steel ships. And he said that if it would go through, he would have at least 1,000 men working for him. Well, of course, this working force never did reach this amount, from what I can understand. And sometimes I think they said this more or less like a political reason, well, because this would kind of make him look good in the eyes of the creditor. And, well, geez, he's going to have 1,000 men working for him. He's must going to have a big business. Well, we'll extend his credit a little bit further. But from what I can really gather in the kind of reading between the lines, I don't think his yard got to 1,000 men because of the area the yard covered. Now, in 1888, he bought the old Chemical Works property, which he paid approximately, I believe it was about $25,000 for that. And then he also bought the old Keystone Mill property and paid approximately the same price for that. And this gave him quite a large yard. And he boasted that he could have 12 vessels going at one time. And I know in 1888, when he launched, I could look it up. I don't know if it's important, the name of a vessel. But he... his yard was so full that he launched his vessel stern first, where they usually launch the vessel sideways into the water. His vessel had to be launched from the stern first because his yard was just so filled to capacity. And this, of course, would have a big impact on the economy.
Mm-hmm.
He would have to put a lot of money into this addition to his property for buildings and whatnot. So he asked that in order to get on his feet, that if the city, now we're talking about the city as West Bay City, that if they would freeze his taxes for 10 years, because he said that it increases taxes according to his property, that if it would, of course, it would be slow getting going on this building of steel ships, that this would eat his profits right up and he couldn't survive. So commission said they couldn't, mayor said he couldn't do this, so they appointed a citizens committee. They went off through West Bay City. Everybody said, yes, we'll be glad to exempt his taxes for 10 years, in which they did. And this gave him, another economic boost for his business. And I guess that's...
Let's turn the conversation away from Captain Davison's yard for a little while here, and concentrate mostly on Frank Wheeler's shipyard. Now, just exactly when did his shipyard begin? I know it's 1877, but to what can we attribute his great success and the longevity of his business compared with that of Captain Davison's?
Well, I haven't really. I'm just now starting at the beginning of his business. Imagine he'd probably come here for the same reason that Mr. Wheeler did. Shipbuilding was a promising business. Bay City was an excellent port for building these vessels. The material was at hand. Of course, your pine and oak was just a few miles, let's say, outside of town by rail to obtain it. And then he was going to get into big business, and he just continued to locate here. And he maintained that Bay City had a great future, industrial future. He stated that the iron ore could be brought down from up at Lakehead to Bay City here at a much lower freight rate than it could be transferred to, let's say, Chicago or New York or any place like this along the Lakes Cleveland that made steel. And he had visions of seeing large steel mills built right here in Bay City, which made sense because If you look at a map of the lakes, you can see that if you draw a line from Bay City across the lakes, there are no real big steel mills around. There's one, of course, now at the Sioux. But at that particular time, Bay City was a very close place to get it. And there's a lot of fresh water, nice river. Of course, takes a lot of water for making the steel. And he had real big visions of seeing something happen here. I'm kind of glad it didn't go. Have another Gary, Indiana, or something like that.
The river be blue, worse than it is now.
Yeah. But he also built a very superior vessel. He put more into it than what it really called for. His men were very well versed in building vessels. Of course, they come right from the wood shipbuilding trade, right into the steel. And there really isn't, the construction is practically the exact same of building a wooden ship as a steel vessel, except there's more work to it and a lot more trickier, because you have bending a steel plate and rolling it is a lot harder than bending an oak plank.
Well, then could you say that where Davison's yard, or where Davison's success started to diminish, that Wheeler's increased, or let me state the question another way. Was Wheeler's success due to the fact that he knew that wooden shipping, the building of wooden ships was almost
extinct,
yeah, that's a good word, at that point, and that steel ships were the coming thing. Now, did Davison, we know, also realize this, but did the fact that Wheeler was around a little longer relate back to the fact that he decided to go into steel shipbuilding and Davison didn't?
Yes.
Or were there other factors in there, too?
Well, I think the big thing, Mr. Davison already was making his money. He had it. Of course, he had his, like I said before, he built his own ships. There was no cost to him there, just the cost value. Mm-hmm. Then he went right into the trade with these vessels, and he was making money. And Mr. Wheeler was just a plain businessman. He just made the vessels because he wanted vessels. And he seen the future of a steel vessel. Of course, some of the early 600-foot, what they call 600-foot class vessels, were built here in Bay City. And you figure they'd hold probably almost three times what a wooden vessel would hold. So there was a need for them, and he had the plant here. And why should he get out of business when business was going good? And people, like I say, were buying steel vessels. This was the upcoming thing.
Well, the real start of the the steel vessel trade began in the late 1890s, am I correct? And then the early 1900s?
No, 1889.
Oh, 1889, that early, I didn't realize.
Yes. He built his first steel vessel he built was a passenger steamer, and that was the first steel hog vessel. And it was more or less like an experimental stage, and it also had electric lights in it and whatnot. Mm-hmm. This is kind of interesting, too, because Wheeler was, I guess, getting kind of ahead of his time in a lot of things. He built the first steel light vessels. These were light ships that were put out on the Atlantic coast. And of course, this helped because he was in politics. He would have been the first shipbuilder in the lakes to build war vessels. But according to the Treaty of 1812, there'd be no armed vessels built on the lakes. And of course, he lost out on this. He also used electric lights in his plant, which was a big novelty. In order to bend steel plates and the ribs of the ships and that, of course, you needed heat. Coal was abundant here, but he didn't really need the coal, because he said coal was a very uneven heat. You couldn't control it. So he built what they call a refinery, if you want to call it that. He took crude oil and he refined it down to a raw stage of gasoline. And he used this gasoline on a big blower system and blew it into these furnaces. Would heat the steel much faster and much even quicker heat. So he just was really on the go for shipbuilding. He knew what was in demand. The only thing he lost out on was his wages. That's where he lost his business, was in labor strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And, by this time, Davison was completely out of business. He didn't build any more vessels. Oh, he built a few dump scows and stuff like this, but he didn't really, he wasn't really building big vessels anymore. Some of his, Davidson's vessels, for example, the Sacramento, which still lies in Bay City, was built in 1896. And he took in the, this vessel lasted, was sailing even in 1933, but it was falling apart, and of course it still lies here in Bay City. And there are many, many Wheeler's Wheeler vessels are still afloat today. One of them is the Niagara, which is the oldest vessel afloat today in the United States under the United States flag, and was built in 1897. And of course the American shipyard took over, and they built some of your big ships, such as Edward Kendricks, the Henry Phipps, Daniel J. Morrell, which was sunk.
All right, now, what is the labor situation in the shipyards in Bay City at this time? Again, we're concerned primarily with the Davidson Yard and the Wheeler Yard. Where are they, the men that are working on these ships, where are they coming from? What makes them decide that they want the shipbuilding industry as a career? Now, I realize that a lot of these people, these employees, were unskilled labor. But what about the people like, say, the riveters, and we've talked about master carpenters, things like that. Where were these men coming from? Was Davidson and Wheeler bringing these men in from the shipyards in the east, or where was he getting them in? And what made them decide to stay in Bay City?
Well, one thing, the riveters were being brought in from the east because people here did not know anything about riveting, so they had to get skilled labor from some particular place other than Bay City. Let's say they brought in, 20 riveters, for example, for Wheeler's Yard. Well, with 20 riveters, it wouldn't take long to put apprentices with them to learn the trade. And the same with carpenters at the Davidson Yard. You'd have, Mr. Jones, for example, was a master carpenter. Well, his son would work with Mr. Jones at the shipyard, and his son would pick up the trade, and this would be handed down like father-to-son type business. And also, if the yard foreman probably seen that a man was particularly mechanically inclined or handy with tools, this man would be watched and would be given a better position right along, because eventually he would be a leader of men and show him how to do this. Most of it was just people came to work, was it, like I said, unskilled labor. Probably one skilled laborer would have maybe 5 or 10 unskilled people working with him, and he would show them what to do, and gradually it would follow through. Other than that, I've never run across that they really went out looking all over for people, except when they needed a particular job done. The people that weren't here available, they'd go maybe hire 2 or 3 from some place and bring them in, and they would teach other people to do the work.
Well, now I imagine that this, and we're talking the late 1800s now, or even, say, the early 1800s, the union movement throughout the United States as a whole was really starting to snowball. It had a snowball effect at this particular time in our nation's history. And, of course, now we know that the Tri-City area is a very strong union, a very great union stronghold. But we've talked about, again, the strike at the Davidson Yard for, I believe it was 12.5 cents more a day, and the Davidson said, well, the heck with this, and he threw out these men and got all the men. Now, how long could these shipbuilders like Wheeler and Davidson, I assume there were little problems like this at Wheeler's Yard too, how long could these two shipbuilders get away with things like this before the men that they had working for them decided, well, we're going to strike and they're not going to hire anybody else? In other words, did unions as such, or guilds, or anything of this type, any societies like this, really have any effect upon the building of ships, basically?
Yes. One particular strike at Wheeler's, the men building iron ships walked off the job for more money. At the same time, the men building wooden ships were afraid to walk off the job because they realized what was happening. You know, wooden ships were on the way out, and they were a little bit scared, and they didn't honor the picket, or the union or picket, whatever you want to call it, these men at first. Well, they finally talked, and they decided, well, look, if we're going to get a raise, why don't you come out with us and you'll get a raise too? And they agreed, and they finally, one by one, gradually, within a day or two, they had the shipyard shut down, and Mr. Wheeler come out and bow to their demands of higher pay, working conditions. You don't hear too much about that, except there was a tremendous amount of accidents in these yards. People even to the extent of getting killed. But this was an occupational hazard. There was no... you weren't going to go up to the boss and say, that's unsafe over there, you know. You would have said, well, go outside, you've got somebody else waiting to take your place. His big problem started in the 1890s with Mr. Wheeler. Davidson, he didn't have too many problems because by 1890s he was pretty well set in his ways of not expanding his shipyard any longer. But your big unions really hit Wheeler in the late 1890s. And after two or three strikes, of course, these big ships, these big syndicates out of New York, especially the Rockefeller interest in that, they needed so many ships to meet the demands of their steel mills, and they had to have them. Well, for every day that a ship was still on the ways, not launched after the contract, Mr. Wheeler would have to pay, I can't think of the name, they have a special name for these royalty fees or something like this, extended contracts. And this happened two or three times, you know, and these people were beginning to get a little bit perturbed because they wanted their ships. They needed them. So what they did, Mr. Wheeler went to these people and said, look, I'm building you a far superior ship than any other shipbuilder can build you. Like I said before, it's true today because a lot of these ships are still afloat. So these big syndicates knew this, that Wheeler was giving them a superior vessel. So they said, okay. So they gave him some money. They said, we'll back you, plus we won't charge you these extended contract fees. Mm-hmm. So he said, okay. Paid off his men. Men started working again. Unions came in again. Started to give him a rough time. And the last time, I'm not exactly sure when, but I believe it. A second here. It was 1898 that when his serious problems really took hold. And around 1899, 1900, the American Shipbuilding Company took over. In the book Freshwater Whales, it gives the exact dates and everything on this. So then Wheeler just more or less dropped out of the picture, and the American Shipbuilding Company took over the yard. And of course, they had their big yard in Lorain, Ohio, and Cleveland, and they had no really intentions of continuing this yard here. And in 1908, the yard was closing up for good
because
one big drawback is that Mr. Wheeler did not have a dry dock, and I believe that if he had a dry dock, the yard would have continued.
Mm-hmm.
But with no dry dock, there was no use bringing a vessel here because you couldn't repair it. There was no way to repair it.
And Wheeler's big problems then stemmed directly from labor.
Directly from labor was the big problem. What was happening, I take it, is that the reason he was getting these contracts, like I said before, he was building a far superior ship, and he was bidding very low on them. In order to get these contracts, he had to bid low. Of course, when you bid low, you're not getting too much money on these vessels, and when your men demand more wages, you have to pay them wages, plus the cost of material is no doubt going up, because out east, the unions, I imagine, were pushing too in the steel mills and that.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, when your price of material goes up and your labor goes up, you can't no longer keep asking or putting low bids on vessels and expect to get them out. And this is what was happening.
Were there any types of fringe benefits or anything like that you've come across in your research that Wheeler or Davidson offered?